today on Doomed! When misinformation actors and white supremacists get deplatformed and banned from the major tech hubs and social media platforms like Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, and elsewhere, they often find home somewhere else. And that's quickly becoming peer-to-peer technology outlets. Today on the show, we will discuss what white supremacists are doing with this peer-to-peer technology and what we can do about it. And without any further ado, well, actually first, patreon.com/MattBinder to support this show, youtube.com/MattBinder to subscribe to the YouTube channel for the live stream, and doomedpod.com for the audio version of this show, which comes out after this live show. Without any further ado, let me bring up my guest for tonight. And once again, I'm using the wrong feed here. One second. How does this always happen to me? Always some sort of tech issue here on this show, but that's okay. Joining me now. Oh my God, I can't believe all these tech issues. Okay, here we go, finally. Joining me now is data scientist and activist focusing on disinformation and the far right, Emmy Bevensey of Rebellious Data. Emmy, thank you so much for joining me on the show tonight.
Hey, Matt.
I really appreciate you coming on tonight and also for dealing with this tech issue. I don't know what's going on. This happened last week, too, on the show. Something happens when I cut from the intro to my guest, and it just everything goes haywire. But it's now fixed. No more problems. Now we can just get down to the nitty-gritty of all this. So Emmy, you put out this great report, and I want to get the name of the report absolutely right, because I think people should search this. There's a link on the Patreon page and in the YouTube description, so if you're lazy and just want to click on something, it's there. But if you like searching on Google or whatever, you could go to just type in the Decentralized Web of Hate. White supremacists are using peer-to-peer technology. Are we prepared? Now, Emmy, can you break down this report? And that's what we're going to do tonight, break down the report. But before we do that, can you explain to people who might not be familiar exactly what is peer-to-peer technology? Because I think when most people hear about peer-to-peer technology, if they're even aware, they think of old-school type software or apps like Kazaa or LimeWire. And maybe they're thinking to themselves, wait, what? Neo-Nazis are used, like David Duke is using like Kazaa to spread his white supremacist message? But it's not exactly that.
No, it's pretty much that. Just Nazis are downloading shit on LimeWire.
Except it's labeled like NoFX unreleased hits or something like that. Yeah. And you download it and it's David Duke's worst.
He's just mumbling for 3 hours. Yeah. So there's actually a lot of like debate and inside baseball about like what is decentralized versus what is distributed, what is the D-web, peer-to-peer. There's all these different terms bouncing around. But the basic idea that you need to understand is that when you go on the internet, your computer has an address, kind of like your mailbox is your address of your house. That's called an IP address. And your computer uses that address to communicate usually with a server. And a server is like, just picture a really big computer in a room or, you know, a whole field of these really big computers somewhere. And your computer's like, hey, can I have some data for this website? And the server's like, yeah, bro, here's some memes. And that's how it works. Everyone at once is asking the server for little packets of data. But the internet wasn't always like that. When the internet was being kind of created, there was a lot of different proposals for what direction it could ultimately go in. And a lot of them were much more decentralized than this kind of like, you know, massively centralized system where you know, everyone's asking this one point for data. And so there's kind of been a resurgence in technologies that are more decentralized. And what I mean by that is, well, an easy example, I think, to understand it is the technology scuttlebutt, which is like a, well, I'll say something different, which is that there's protocols, and a protocol is like, it's like a way for, it's like a piece of software. It's like a language kind of that you can speak and communicate with each other. And so scuttlebutt is like this protocol which lets devices talk to each other. And on top of it, you can build anything. So like mostly what's been built has been social media platforms. And so like instead of asking a server somewhere in Silicon Valley or whatever, hey, can I have the data for this website? Each computer now will just host a bunch of the data for like its friends. Like I'll keep all the stories of my friends in my head. And then everyone, when they see me, you can ask, hey, do you have any new gossip about so-and-so? And I'll be like, oh yeah, here's a little bit of new gossip about that. Oh, here's a little bit of new information about that person. And so in this way, we're all becoming the servers. So it's kind of hard to show that without like, you know, a diagram. I should have brought like a little piece of paper.
Right,
but instead
right.
of like a peer, the server at the top and all of us at the bottom as computers, we're all creating our own system of communication.
Right. And so I'm trying to think of what I guess a more recent, other than Kazaa and LimeWire, a more recent like example. I guess the Pirate Bay, the way people get...
Torrenting is arguably a peer-to-peer technology because we're all saying like, hey, can I have little pieces of this data, of this file, of like Gossip Girl or whatever?
You know? Right.
And no, just kidding. No one would ever steal intellectual property. things that don't happen.
Right. And that Gossip Girl download, again, it's David Duke mumbling, unfortunately.
Yeah. So like certainly torrenting is an example. But there's a lot of like, there's this huge ecosystem of these new technologies. Maybe another infamous one is blockchain technologies. Like everyone's heard of Bitcoin now, even if you don't know what it is. Even if all you've, I don't know if you've seen that meme where they're like, my girlfriend doesn't understand blockchain. Can someone explain it to her? And then someone's like, oh yeah, blockchain is like running your car for 4 hours so that it can solve Sudokus that can help you buy heroin on the deep web. that's my short explanation of Bitcoin.
Right. And by the way, it just hit 20K for the first time. So, I mean,
I wish,
maybe back in the day, I'd not thought it was so dumb just so I could have a little bit of Bitcoin. But, well.
So like, blockchain technologies are just like, it's just like a mathematical proof of who sends what to what. And like my wallet has this much of this coin or whatever, this much, and I gave it to this person and we all mathematically agree that that happened. And since it's happening in a decentralized way, like all these different, their logs are being, the ledger of what's being, you know, exchanged is being distributed across many places. So I say it's like a peer-to-peer technology.
Right. Right. So I think, you know, even a layperson has at least a rough idea of what peer-to-peer technology is at this point. I really do think you've laid it out quite well. So let's now jump into what this report focuses on, because I mean, it's something that I think a lot of people who have paid attention to the far right have noticed, but I don't know if everyone has even noticed. I mean, and of course there's people who haven't noticed at all, and that's the broader, you know, public here. But even people who pay attention, I don't think they've noticed just how many facets of different sort of platforms have been replaced by peer-to-peer technology for white supremacists and the far right. And you really break down a number of different, forms of technology that the white supremacists have been able to use peer-to-peer technology for. So let's just jump right in. How basically are white supremacists using peer-to-peer technology? Is it basically their last way to reach out to the broader public and, of course, each other? To spread their hateful messages after being deplatformed from so many mainstream social media sites, and I mean, not even just social media sites, like PayPal has dropped a number of these actors, being that PayPal doesn't want to fund these hateful groups. So it's really, I mean, they've lost everything that you and I use to basically exist on the internet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so just to be clear, I support deplatforming of fascists just because I acknowledge that it creates this new field of struggle and investigation. I still think it's a good idea to like get fascists kicked off of their you know, DDoS protection and their payment platforms and not host them on your podcast and stuff like that. Not your podcast, but
right.
The broader podcast ether. So I recognize the value of that work. But yeah, so say your whole little dweeby Nazi website is like running on PayPal and you're accepting donations for a long time, and then anti-fascists like find your website and then they openly are just like, hey, can people report this? And then like, you know, thousands of liberals or whatever also like tag in to like support, to, you know, write little messages to PayPal being like, hey, I think you should take this down. And then PayPal bans you. Suddenly you've lost most of your income stream for your dweeby little project. And so what they mostly do then, what's probably the most common form of like fascist use of peer-to-peer technology, is then they just start up setting up cryptocurrency donations. Like websites like the Daily Stormer, Fascist Forge, pretty much any modern fascist site that you go to will have like a Bitcoin donation and maybe an Ethereum donation. And if they're more privacy conscious, maybe like a Monero wallet that people can send money to. And that helps to protect their identities and the identities of people who are giving them money. And so
now, do you find, being that you just brought that up, I just want to ask, do you find that white supremacists and far right figures who use this technology, do you find that they sort of get into it based on necessity, and that these extra privacy features are just an additional bonus that come with it? Or do you find that they're actually moving towards it specifically for the privacy features?
I mean, both. Yeah, both are happening at the same time. Like, obviously, for example, the US government is not that active in its like taking on of white supremacist groups, but to some extent the FBI will occasionally arrest like prominent Nazis from groups, and so they are like paranoid in their own right to the extent they're not actively collaborating with state forces, as we've seen extensively, right?
Yeah.
But they're super paranoid. Like, I was joking with someone recently because Adam Waffen got infiltrated by both the FBI and anti-fascist groups at the same time. And we were joking like, man, this Adam Waffen channel must have been 70% infiltrators from different groups and law enforcement agencies from the beginning.
Right.
So they do have a reason to be paranoid. And so, yeah, they are seeking these things out, and there's like all these guides on how to use decentralized technology. You can find the little discussion board chats around it and stuff like that.
Right. And I guess their biggest worry, even beyond, law enforcement is, in a sense where they have to worry about law enforcement. If they're not law enforcement themselves, I guess their worry is also that it'll come out that they are, an individual is part of one of these groups, and they'll possibly lose their income stream, their job, their livelihood.
and their family. Like, normal people don't like Nazis, you know what I mean?
Right, like, right.
Normal people are not like internet weeboo Nazis.
Right. You know? Well, you never know. There could be a whole, I'm sure there's at least a few actually white supremacist weeboo families out there. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. They met on one of the boards and they lived happily ever after with two kids. And I mean, there was that story, and I'll never forget it, of that the Nazi father who named his kid Adolf Hitler. I mean, there was a mother involved who had no problem with that, obviously. I mean.
Oh, yeah. Like, yeah. People be doing intergenerational stupid shit, for sure.
Yep. So.
Yeah.
A lot of, you know, and like I mentioned earlier, I think maybe the fundraising part of all this is the one most people are familiar with.
Yeah.
You know, obviously.
Yeah.
I mean, it's still surprising, I think, whenever it comes out. That what's his face? Weave. Was when his like cryptocurrency wallet funds were made public, and it was something like he had like tens of thousands of dollars from donations in his Bitcoin wallet. It's like, you know, that's when it gets a little bit mind blowing. I mean, not everyone is making as much as him, but he is one of the bigger figures in that sort of techno Nazi world. But it still is astonishing. But I think that is one area where most people are familiar with how they're using peer-to-peer. But in your report, you go to some other, and I think people aren't so familiar with some of these other ways that neo-Nazis and white supremacists are using peer-to-peer. Can you go into some of these other non-financial ways?
Yeah, I just want to be clear before I talk about these that I'm not like saying these technologies are inherently bad. I'm just trying to be realistic about the ways that they're going to be used. Like, right. actually, I think these projects are super exciting. Like, I've hung out with developers from these projects, and for the most part, the developers from these projects are like, oh yeah, we hate Nazis, you know, but there are just risks associated with developing new technologies.
Right. Like, and one thing to add there too, like, you know, we love on our, you know, for more people to understand this, like, a lot of people love social media. Like, for all the complaining about Facebook and YouTube and Twitter, we all spend a lot of time on Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter.
Yeah.
And you know, there's good things that came out of the internet and social media, and there's bad things that have come out of the internet and social media. But one addendum here, I think, is that these platforms you're about to discuss, the developers don't always have like total control over them, like, you know, Mark Zuckerberg, Jack Dorsey, and yeah. Google have over Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube.
Yeah, they certainly don't. But I would argue that like Mark Zuckerberg and them don't really have control over their platforms either. Like, as someone who works in the machine learning field, like, for example, the problem of automated detection of hate speech content, extremely cursed. Like, there are decently smart ways of approaching the problem, but it's kind of inherently cursed. But yeah, so no one controls a peer-to-peer system. That's the point. No one, like, these platforms are by and large completely irrepressible. Like, you can't, like, send a subpoena to the server and be like, take it down. There is no server to send a subpoena to. You could seize someone's computer, but the network is resilient. It'll just route around. You know what I mean?
Right.
So yeah. To an extent, that's what makes these technologies really complicated. But arguably, like, you know, books have negative externalities. Like, Nazis wrote books, so we should ban books, you know? So there's some like element of things like that. Okay, yeah, so some of the other technologies that I talk about in the report are like, for example, file hosting. Like IPFS, the Interplanetary File System, super cool decentralized file sharing program that's being used for all kinds of cool stuff around the world. After the Christchurch terror attack, the manifesto was taken down all across the internet. And so the owner of this like Nazi web hosting service was like, yeah, I'm going to post it on IPFS so no one can ever take it down again. And you could have like some debate about like, can you get rid of these ideas or whatever? But nonetheless, it remains that, like, okay, now this exists forever, ostensibly, as long as the internet exists and computers exist. And some of the other ones are like encrypted communications technologies, Matrix, which used to be used Riot, now I think it's called Element, or there's a bunch of other platforms on it. People, like, I've seen a bunch of different groups associated with like the base and Atomoff and stuff like that being like, oh, you got to join our Riot chat room, and or like go to this link, or join, we'll only message you on this app. That being said, of course, centralized apps exist that they use too, like Wire or Signal or something like that.
Right.
Aren't
those a little bit like Signal and Telegram especially, that's become especially popular with white supremacists and the far right. They're sort of like correct me if I'm wrong, I sort of interpret them as like an in-between where there is a organization or company that has basically like a power over the entire platform. However, they don't really have any power over seeing the messaging. That's between user to user, but they do like host the overall group.
Yeah. I would argue that Telegram cannot make that claim, or they have not sufficiently proven to be able to make that claim. And most Telegram messages are not encrypted. Hmm. You have to like be on a one-on-one message and choose secret chat or whatever. Like those big public Telegram groups, I scrape those. You know what
okay,
I mean? Like
right.
I create. So it's like they have URLs that I can go to.
Right.
You know. But Signal, yeah. There's centralized servers, but it's end-to-end encryption, which just means that they don't have access to your decryption keys. Your decryption keys are stored locally on your device. So when Signal gets subpoenaed, all they can say is whether you have Signal installed, when's the last time you logged in. They can't say like any more metadata than that.
Right. Do they have the power to just ban a user though?
I'm not sure. Oh. Maybe someone in the comments will hop in.
Right.
I'm not sure. I've heard about Telegram banning channels. Telegram bans channels to some
right.
extent. Maybe theoretically they could. I'm not sure how it would be done. Yeah.
Interesting. So what was I going to say? So on these peer-to-peer message boards and forums, are they basically just treating it how they would treat any other social media platform? Or is there something else that they are basically – or are they using this as more of a private channel? Like, are they basically just still trying to you know, voice their opinion on certain issues and spread the word about things? Or is it mainly being used to, like, organize actions?
Yeah. So I guess the other two categories that are usually – that I didn't mention before are, like, yeah, social media kind of applications. I'll just start with that one. Like, social media app – yeah, like, Gab – oh, social media applications and, like, server – kind of things like that, like federated server systems. And sometimes those overlap. So an example of that would be the Mastodon federated server technology was used by Gab when Gab kept having problems and getting deplatformed. And the Mastodon community is pretty broadly anti-fascist, like the development community. And so they, you know, put out centralized statements asking servers not to federate with Gab, just for those that don't know, Gab is like a, you know, wink, wink, nudge, nudge free speech platform.
Right.
But there's been a bunch of studies about it that it's just like basically an alt-right echo chamber.
Right. It's even worse than Parler, like, in my opinion, in terms of, like, if you were compare the two, like, there's a lot of, like, yeah, you see these people on Parler as well, but there's also a lot of just, like, weird regular MAGA types who are just like, you know, a patriot grandpa on there, you know, but on Gab, when you're on Gab, it's usually because you are an upfront, out and out, you know, white supremacist, or at the very least an online reactionary part of some sort of far right community.
Yeah. Like there's definitely probably there's a bunch of normie users on Gab too, but like I've certainly found tons of old Adam Woffen accounts and the base accounts and stuff like that.
Right.
There's no shortage of hardcore niche fash esoteric policy, you know, politics. Someone like just rolled a dice and just randomly generated an identity because they felt like their life was boring.
That would be, if you're looking for an app idea, that would be a fantastic app. Like
the ideology.store or something like that. And it just randomly generates, I forget what the exact link is, but it just randomly generates identities. But that's how I feel studying fascists a lot of times.
Especially now since the rise of Donald Trump, I feel like there's a whole community of like very confused people who don't know what they believe, and they're taking different things from different places and just combining them into some sort of weird, new, very specific niche ideologies.
And flipping super rapidly because they don't actually have any ideological coherence and it's all an aesthetic game to them.
Right. I mean, I feel like you're almost specifically calling out the Tulsi Gabbard fans. I mean, honestly, that's what it feels like.
Yeah, there's been a problem on the left where, like, you can be as racist as you want as long as you say free Assange and people just give you a pass.
Yeah. I mean, while we're on that, actually, I mean, listen, you can advocate that Julian Assange should not be tried for what he did with WikiLeaks, but it doesn't mean you have to defend the complete body of work of Julian Assange. Like, if there's a non-journalism or whistleblower or leak-related crime that he is found to be at least accused of, then you don't have to defend him for that part of it. You know, like, let's...
Yeah, another big bulk of my research has been on Red Brown stuff, which has made me a lot of email enemies. But that's like weird forms of fascist entryism on the left. But I won't get into that.
Maybe another show.
Yeah. But yeah, so there's all these technologies. I'm actually really excited about them. I'm deeply a part of a lot of peer-to-peer communities, but I'm just like trying to ask us to be, you know, realistic about them. Kind of a cool example to mention, like one of the projects that I'm most excited about is I have this friend who like lives in a Quilombo, which is like a like escaped enslaved people like semi-autonomous communities in Brazil, and he lives there and he's indigenous, and he works on, basically he's trying to make decentralized internet infrastructure for different indigenous nations and quilombos in Brazil, particularly in the Amazon jungle. So he like goes around with little like, you know, sort of like cheap knockoff telephone poles and uses all these like open source software that he's developing, and then is basically trying to make infrastructure so that in the event of collapse or like racist denial of access to internet or communications infrastructure, they can have these cheap, you know, solar powered, resilient communication infrastructure. And like projects like that, I'm just like, this is so fucking cool, man. Like,
right.
Makes me so excited for like a kind of solar punk future.
Right. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of, technology is just basically how people choose to use it. I mean, a lot of this tech you're mentioning in the peer-to-peer world, it seems like it's just being weaponized for you know, nefarious reasons by white supremacists. But the overall tech, obviously, I mean, think about if you are an anti-fascist activist and you use one of these peer-to-peer, I mean, they do use it, one of these peer-to-peer communication platforms to basically organize. That way the cops can't sort of shut you down or know where you're going to be, and you could take part in these sorts of direct actions. The unfortunate thing is white supremacists are also using it for that very same reason. Yeah.
Yeah. Like in the Scuttlebutt community, there's a lot of conversations about like one of the main features that like queer and POC communities have been asking for is private rooms, like private communities. And it's tricky because the same reasons that like queers and other marginalized groups want this technology is the same reason that Nazis want it. You know, I mean, obviously to different ends, like we just want it so that we can have a safer place to, you know, not be persecuted or whatever. And they want it to organize racist violence. But the reason that we both want it is that it's like safer, more secure, more resilient. All the things that are beneficial to me are also beneficial to people that I oppose. Also, like, you know, with any of these technologies, it obviously brings up like the potential for risk about child abuse content and other things like that. So there's like anytime you have some kind of system, like arguably the entire internet, you're going to have like these super gross bad actors. And so I feel like part of the way of dealing with that is just to be really frank about the risks and try to address them to whatever extent we can.
So what can be done, if anything, about you go through this in the report. What can be done, if anything, about how white supremacists are weaponizing these technologies?
So well, there's a lot of different angles, and there's some limits to it, right? Like freedoms come with risks. There's limits to what's possible. And the example of Mastodon that I mentioned before is a common one across a lot of peer-to-peer platforms, which is basically like, we should try to isolate them. Like it's a decentralized system, but we should put them on a little island where all they have to make their system resilient is their small little sub-community niche. We shouldn't allow them the rich tapestry of hosting and whatnot that we're all kind of in a mutual aid way sharing with ourselves. So there are a lot of technologies you can do this kind of like isolating. And then like some communities do different things, like it sounds cheesy, but like aesthetic choices. Like if you make a technology as a free speech platform, because of the way that dog whistles work, that's going to be more far right. Even though historically free speech is a leftist issue, like sedition charges were primarily at Black Lib activists, and like Emma Goldman, I think, was deported for sedition. You know, so, but if you say like we're a free speech platform, you're going to be Gab. You're going to have tons of Nazis, like 8kun. You know, arguably anybody could set up a board on 8kun, but like so weird, it just ends up being super fascist.
Right. Right. I wonder if that had anything to do with the people who run it, but who knows, right? I mean, the Watkins family, I wonder if they have anything to do with that, right?
I'll give you a little exclusive scoop here and your followers, which is that in the next week or so, if you follow my timeline, I'm going to have a huge story on 8kun and Jim Watkins and their kind of communication infrastructure and who they've been communicating with and stuff like that. So stay tuned.
Give me 1 second. Being that we have some breaking news on here, I have to play the DJ air horn effect. I don't know if you hear it. Now, I've actually written some things about Watkins, Jim Watkins, and 8kun, and I know you can't give away too much yet, but have you finally officially unveiled that he is Q?
I think that based on the information we have, it would be irresponsible to make any claims about who or what Q is. I will say, like, I wrote a bunch of stuff about trip codes and, like, really bizarre irregularities in their encryption system that I think are extremely sketchy, but it wasn't really – it ended up getting cut from this story because it's a little bit of a tangent.
All right.
But that being said, it's pretty interesting who they're talking to. We'll talk – but we can catch up about that later.
Ooh.
It's Spicy.
I know. You might be back on this show sooner than you expected.
I mean, I'm having fun. So there's something to be said about aesthetic choices. Like Scuttlebutt, you know, on their homepage advertises like they have like kind of pastel colors, and their homepage is like a cartoon about a queer interracial couple, you know, like just, and they have content warnings and a lot of the clients and stuff like that, that is like an anti, is a vice signal, is an anti-virtue signal in a lot of far right communities. Obviously, since it's open source, they could fork it and make their own version, you know, that's like much more fash friendly or whatever, but it won't get maintained. You know what I mean? None of the development community will support it. Like one of the issues is there are always points of centralization in a lot of these things. So like IPFS, for example, I talked to them at some gathering back before everything. And I was like, hey, did you know about this manifesto thing? And they're like, oh, that sucks. We'll make sure that it's not on our main portal, because like they have a, you know, a sort of central, more centralized version of it that you can go through to easily get started on the technology. And so they can make sure that it's not on that most commonly used one, even if that doesn't stop like other smaller groups from using it. And then like anti-fascist tactics will still work. Like, you know, infiltration will still work.
Right.
But I think when I try to explain this decentralized technology to people, they usually get really confused, because they're like, they'll ask me questions like, how many Nazis are using decentralized technology? And I'm like, well, it's impossible to know. And they're like, well, then how do you know it's a threat? And I'm like, well, because we can see the tips of the iceberg. You know, we can see them talking about it in public forums. We can see, you know, some Bitcoin logs. We can see, like, people talking about things happening in other technologies and stuff like that. But the point is, the FBI or whoever can't just, like, they can't do an NSA in the same way that, like, they would like to. They can't do the same degree of surveillance. And so that'll be true of activist groups too, who have like a set of tactics that they've gotten used to using on centralized platforms, which aren't going to work the same
on
a lot of platforms, but some of them will, of course.
Right. I mean, from what it sounds like, it sort of seems like, you know, I have this, the same sort of belief in terms of, you know, when a white supremacist or a disinformation actor basically gets removed from a mainstream platform, that's good, because the threat there is that they're able to spread their ideology to the masses, and people will fall for this sort of stuff. And whether it's white supremacy and falling down the rabbit hole of becoming a you know, going all the way to becoming a neo-Nazi and you know, or just even just spreading misinformation, something about the coronavirus vaccine, and they see it on Facebook or Twitter, and they say, "Oh, that's horrible! I gotta let my friends and family know about this," and they spread this bullshit. So that's good when they're deplatformed off of there for those reasons. But it's sort of also good that they exist somewhere online, away from the mainstream general public. Because I think it would be really bad, actually, if they took everything completely offline, where you couldn't track the actors, you couldn't track what the current, you know, talking points were, or what they were currently doing in terms of, their plans for spreading their hateful ideologies or disinformation. So the idea that they're on these platforms that really only, you know, the most hardcore of either anti-fascists who go after them, or even just people who are really tech savvy, who know how to access these platforms, can see them. I think that's sort of not the worst case scenario. And in fact, there's so many positives to that.
Yeah. So you bring up a lot of interesting points. So the first one you bring up is like, on Twitter, it's really easy to get your message out to a large audience. If you get deplatformed off Twitter or this payment processor or this other thing, then you go to this more niche thing. Like, for example, like a lot of FASH like to use onion sites that are only accessible by Tor. But by the time you're on an onion site, you're already going to eliminate like 96% of your potential audience who might otherwise see it, but who now aren't because they're not going to download Tor. They're not going to learn some obscure new technology. Like your average boomer grandpa isn't going to be like, you know, oh, I'm just going to do, do, do.
Right. So I mean, they're even losing people just by using Parler, and that's a publicly accessible, you know, mainstream, I guess you can say, right wing site. It's just the fact that once you are creating a niche community, you're automatically just losing people who just spend all their time on, you know, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, YouTube. I mean, there's a reason why YouTube has been like the number one driver of radicalizing young white men. And that's because they're already on there consuming other content, and then they fall on the far right stuff, and then they fall down into that rabbit hole of consuming it all.
Yeah. And, you know, that there are some dark sides to this too, which is like, okay, now they're not on Twitter, so they don't have to hide it at all. So it's only the most hardcore people, but then they can engage in like actual, you know, explicit like what they want and how they want to do it and try to organize and stuff like that in a way that maybe they'd be more cautious on Twitter. So that's kind of one bad side. But the other part of it is that it's like, I guess in computer science, we'd call it like an adversarial problem. And what I mean by that is as you adapt to each new phase of the like war or whatever, the whole situation becomes more complex and it goes up to it ratchets up to a new level. So what I mean by that is like, at first there's all these technologies that are really new. They're kind of buggy. They're kind of hard to access. The features don't really work that well. So it eliminates a lot of people that wouldn't use it otherwise. But as those people get deplatformed, they move over to this technology. It has more users. As it has more users, it gets more funding. As it gets more funding, some of the bugs work out. Like Bitcoin is pretty accessible now. The old days where you needed like this advanced wallet key management system, and you had to like, you know, buy it from some sketchy dude on the corner is gone. Like you can get it in Cash App. You know what I mean? You can buy it on tons of apps and it's like seamless. So these technologies are going to get more popular and more commonplace. There's also an argument in decentralized communities that the model of the web that we have now is not sustainable. And so it's going to kind of collapse under the weight of its own internal contradictions. I mean, that may or may not be true, but if it is true, there's going to be mass rush to peer-to-peer systems that already have a leg up. Like an example of that is if Trump got his way on removing Section 230 of platform, which is like this platform responsibility thing. Basically, it says that platforms are not liable for content on their websites, and he wants to get rid of it. If that did happen, it would probably collapse a lot of the mainstream platforms like Twitter. And so there's an argument to be said that, you know, that alone could push a ton more people, maybe not all these people who are used to this technology, but a ton more people. And so in any case, in each new phase, like Nazis are bad at using this technology right now, so it's easy to find them using it, but then they get exposed, and then they get a little bit better at it. You know, it's kind of an ongoing back and forth. So it's a tricky question, but I think it's just like I guess the point in my report was that I wanted people to take away was the way that we solve these problems in peer-to-peer systems is a lot closer to how we solve them in communities, which is to say it's hard. You can't just like entrust some central authority to like protect you. Like you, right, as a community, we need to moderate our content together. You know what I mean? We need to do the work of not spreading these messages and rather than right now, most moderation is outsourced like to Mechanical Turk workers on, you know, through Amazon or whatever. A lot of it's done in the global south, and it'll be like really gory, traumatic shit. And they're like, hey, is this gory and traumatic? You know, and these people are paid like nothing to do that. Right. And so a peer-to-peer system takes away that whole thing. It's up to us now. And so I think the reason why that technology is exciting and terrifying is it's kind of like this offer to evolve the way that we interact and connect online, and that's going to be challenging kind of inherently.
Right. What was that? I'm sorry.
But more sustainable in the end.
Right. The interesting thing is I came across your report actually while I was doing putting together a piece about BitChute. And we haven't talked about BitChute yet, and I sort of wanted to leave it to the end because it's interesting. You brought up before how free, because it's not in your report, but I wanted to bring it up anyway, because you brought up before how, you know, sort of how like the words free speech are a great way to describe a lot of peer-to-peer platforms, like one of the positives about, you know, peer-to-peer platforms in terms of actually being able to, you know, it's mainly a leftist ideal that's sort of been weaponized by the right, and they've taken it. And now whenever you hear free speech, you automatically think a site like Parler or Gab or worse. And in the same way, they're using the words free speech as like a anti-big tech, like marketing sort of tool. Peer-to-peer seems to actually be sort of becoming like that as well, because BitChute is basically this far-right video hosting platform, you know, just like how Parler wants to take on Facebook and Gab wanted to take on Twitter. BitChute is there to sort of take on YouTube as like the right wing's video hosting platform. And one of the things very early on that they promoted was that they were a peer-to-peer sort of platform, whereas, you know, a user watching a video was also sort of seeding that video to another user, and that was their way of sort of letting their users know that, listen, no matter how big we get or whatever, we can never just all of a sudden decide we don't want you guys here anymore because we have no control over the content. And everywhere you look, BitChute was basically boasting about being a peer-to-peer platform in its earliest days. They still mention it. But there's been a number of studies that I came across that basically show that BitChute may be using some sort of on-web peer-to-peer technology, like on their website, basically in like a worst-case scenario, in the best case in terms of they're saying they're peer-to-peer. But there's been numerous times where they've lost like a service provider. Yeah, or yeah. There's been some sort of issue, and the whole site, including all the videos, just comes down. So, I mean, obviously, if it was peer-to-peer, that wouldn't happen. Yeah. The videos would be fine. So do you think that is something that's going to happen in terms of, like, are you familiar with BitChute? Like, do you think it's this, yeah, that they are using this sort of peer-to-peer as, like, a marketing tool now? Like, it's become a thing to sort of lure white supremacist and far-right users in?
Yeah, I think it's a grift. Like, I think for a lot of websites, it's like there was this huge rush of people who claimed that their technology was on the blockchain, and it like wasn't even, or there was no reason for it to be on the blockchain. It's just kind of like a grift. Yeah, I've read some of the articles about BitChute, and I've certainly found tons of like hardcore Nazi content. Including, I was doing an investigation into Iron March forums and Adam Waffen, and I found like old videos of the guy from the base before he was outed as like a sketchy former U.S. Fed that fled right to Russia or whatever. So, I found like old videos of him on there, tons of basically David Duke mumbling kind of videos of people. reading things.
I mean, but BitChute must be, in my estimation, from my own research into it as well, I think it might be the most far right of the easily accessible platforms. Like, you just have to type in BitChute.com and you go to it like any other website. It's not like a hidden, like, special, like, you know, onion site, or you need to be using peer-to-peer technology, meaning that only people within that private network know about it. It really must be the because I've seen some of the same stuff you've come across. Not the base thing, but that's pretty crazy. But, I mean, they're still having the Christchurch live stream shooting video uploaded on that site. And it just, the versions of it just sit there. Like, when it's already actually been pretty much removed from everywhere else, it seems, at least of the easily accessible platforms.
They do take content down if it gets, like, too. That's the thing. Most of these platforms, you can tell that they're not decentralized because they do centralized takedowns. Like, as soon as they get exposed, they, like, start doing centralized takedowns. Parler does takedowns. I think Gab does takedowns. And 8kun certainly does takedowns. I mean, 8kun, they've had a couple of, like, peer-to-peer griffs. You can access 8kun on this thing called LokiNet now, which is, like, this weird server thing. But they've also had this, like, technology that they've been developing that, as far as I know, never really came out. That was, like, going to be some sort of decentralized DNS thing so that they would be more resilient. But yeah, most of these types of things are more complicated, like you said. Like, to do the LokiNet one, you have to, like, have LokiNet set up. You know, you can't just go to their website. Maybe it's, like, seeding their website. I don't totally understand it. But as far as I can tell, they still crash. They still do centralized takedowns. Like, it's not a thing.
All right. I'm sorry. I'm just trying to take in that these right-wing platforms do takedowns. They lied to us about being about free speech. I'm so hurt right now. I can't believe it.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. It's interesting what they do and don't take down, too, right? Like, you know, 8kun was pretty infamous for not taking down child abuse content for a long time. Even, like, archive.today stopped hosting them for a little while. Was like, we just have to block them because we keep getting child abuse content. And this is like a Russian archive website that takes anything. You know what I mean?
Right.
And even they at some point were like, oh, this 8chan shit is too extreme for us.
The global pedophile ring call was coming from inside the house all along, wasn't it? I mean,
that's the whole Save the Children joke. Like, yeah. It exposed that Watkins was hosting all these child abuse websites, and that's where a bunch of his money was coming from. There was, like, a big article that just came out about this.
Right.
They don't suck about the kids.
Yeah, they really... I mean, really, I mean...
It's like Eric Prince level. You're just like, lay it all out. You're like, holy shit, this is too on the nose.
Right. Right. I mean, the whole thing with this year, we really saw it all just come out. It's really like, have you ever seen that meme where it's like, it's the "Don't Tread on Me" flag, and it's the Gadsden flag with the snake, and it's the snake saying, like, you know, no, tread on them, tread on them. It's literally like. Yeah. It's all about their own little, you know, they can't do it, but let it be done to others. Like, the idea that the, you know, they love the police, interestingly enough. The, you know, these same people who, with the "Don't Tread on Me" flag, love the police. However, when the shoe is on the other foot and they're the ones getting the rare cases of police brutality, but we did see it this year where, you know, at some of these coronavirus lockdowns, protests, that the police hassled them, all of a sudden it was like, What? I mean,
we're patriots, dude.
Yeah, it's just stunning. It's just, I mean, no matter how obvious it is that this is what happens, it'll always still be stunning to me because it's just
like this whole thing, the whole point. I'm not going to say that the left is ideologically coherent. The left, in and of itself, as a concept, is not ideologically coherent. But, like, the right is so absurdly incoherent that it's just like it makes your brain split apart. Like, an example relevant to this, like, interview or whatever is the founder of the neo-reactionary movement, Curtis Yarvin, also known as Mencius Moldbug, Dark Enlightenment, all that shit. he's basically a technocrat monarchist. He's like, democracy's bad. We need to have Elon Musk rule the universe, but through fascism, like a fascist techno monarchist.
Right.
That's his great insight. He was like, okay. He was like, okay, now I'm going to get into the peer-to-peer world. And so he tries to build this technology called Urbit, which I don't talk about in the essay, but it's funny. It's like this decentralized federated kind of server technology that's getting really popular in the far right. But what's funny about it is he's like, yeah, it's peer-to-peer. And then you're like, well, what does this have to do with monarchism? Like, he was asked at this point, like, how do you connect this decentralized community like system to your ideology? And he was like, oh, I built it after a monarchy. See, all these different servers are actually like duchies and duchesses and dukes. And like,
I mean, the easiest answer really would have been, and surprisingly he didn't think of this. The easiest answer would be like, when the technology gets big enough, I'm going to gift it to Elon Musk. I mean, yeah. That would have been the simplest thing. And then there you go. It's right there in your ideology.
It's like, it just doesn't make any sense. Like, you can go off the deep end with believing in peer-to-peer technology. You can go off the deep end believing in anything. But there's like some just fundamental contradiction that can, it's like, you know, Zizek, pure ideology kind of thing, where you're just like, wow, dude, you're on one, man.
Right. Emmy Bevensee, data scientist and activist. Check them out at Rebellious Data. Is it rebelliousdata.com? I have it open.
Yep, rebelliousdata.com. We also run like an app for kind of looking at timelines and making really easy like data viz, studying things that are trending on different social media platforms. It's called smat-app.com. We've got a bunch of platforms on there like 8kun, 4chan, Twitter, Reddit, whatever. It's fun to mess with. And also you can follow me on Twitter at Emmy Bevensee. So my name is EMMIBEVENSEE, where I talk a lot of bullshit.
Oh, that's what Twitter's for. Really, thank you so much for joining me tonight. And you're from just your tease with the your upcoming 8kun piece. You're gonna have to come back. I'm sorry.
It's gonna be spicy. I'm pretty excited.
Stop doing this to me. I'm like, now I gotta know. I gotta know.
Yeah, this is a lot of fun. Thanks for having me on.
Have a great night. Take care. Bye. Happy New Year, too, by the way.
Hey, there you go.
All right, ladies and gentlemen. Oh, here we go. Skype shutting off. Boop, boop. All right. Well, let me turn my volume up here, because I know the volume goes down now after the... here we go. Okay, cool. Yeah, that was great. I really enjoyed that interview, and I'm like already, because I have a upcoming in the second half of the show, a little bit of news from in the QAnon world that I'm going to share with all of you. Is a recent study that was released that's very interesting, but freebies aren't going to hear that. It's only for you live stream watchers and you patrons. Patreon.com/MattBinder. That's the best way to support this show. If you can. A couple weeks ago, I should say, I had basically said that I had hoped to hit 200 patrons by the end of the year. I don't think that's going to happen. That seems like a goal that was a bit ahead of its time. But we're literally just like a couple of patrons away from 150 patrons. And it would be awesome if by the end of this show, we hit that. That would make me very happy. So patreon.com/Matt Binder. Again, only if you can financially do so. If not, you could also, if you are financially able to give something but just can't commit to a monthly subscription, you can jump in the YouTube live chat right now, if you're watching live, obviously, youtube.com/Matt Binder, and drop a super chat. It will guarantee, A, that I read your chat in the during the show, and B, it gives me a one-off donation as a I guess, your appreciation for what I do. Also, you could support this show by obviously subscribing to the YouTube channel, youtube.com/Matt Binder. Doomedpod.com for the podcast version of the show. And another way you could support this show is by going to the show on iTunes, Google Play, wherever you listen to the podcasts, and leave not only a star review, whatever their review ranking is off of iTunes. I know iTunes does star reviews. Also leave a written review. I'm not shitting you. These help tremendously. They push the show up the various podcast rankings, which gives the show, puts the show in front of more eyeballs. And also, people like to see, like to consume content that they see other people, A, consuming, and B, very happy about. So let people know that you love this show, if you love it. If you hate it, you can let people know you hate it. I mean, I'm not someone who's gonna tell you have to give me a good review, but you should. You can follow me wherever you're on social media. I'm usually at Matt Binder, like I am on Twitter, Instagram, etc., etc., etc. So many people just start following me on Instagram out of the blue. I don't know what it is. I don't post on Instagram. Every week I say, oh, I want to do more Instagram, and I never do, yet somehow people always are following me on there all of a sudden. I will start doing more Instagram stuff, I guess. Got to start posting more pics and doing vids for Instagram, right? You guys all know me on Twitter, but if you're not already following me on there, follow me on there. For 2021, I should really start doing TikTok. All the youth are on TikTok, and the left's gotta represent for the youth. They gotta bring the youth into the fold here, right? I'm not gonna be a weirdo like Tim Pool and say that I'm gonna, you know, trick youngsters into liking conservative values by talking about like video games and stuff like that. I'm very openly gonna be like, hey, if you like leftist stuff, follow me here, and I'm not gonna do TikTok dances, but I'll make the short form minute long content like I do on here, but for, you know, for TikTok, the short form. Yeah, I mean, you guys know what I'm saying. Also, we've just been fun actually in the Patreon half of the show today. Something not political, just fun type of stuff. If you enjoyed my walkthrough of the studio during the last member show, when I shut off the green screen and I gave you a tour of what's to come in this little closet space that I call a studio, you're probably gonna like this. It involves very old soda I found. That's the hint I'll give you, and the insane clown posse. So that'll be fun. And that's coming up in, I guess I'll say, what, is there anything else I need to promote? No? 3, 2, 1. All right, freebies. See you next time on Doomed.